Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party, another brand new episode. I'm going to have to stop saying that. Just take it as read that they're all new from now on. But isn't it good to be back? Today's guest is Stephen Flynn, the MP for Aberdeen South, only for the last 5 years, less than 5 years, and already leader of the SNP in the House of Commons. We talk about a number of things, but a lot of this is about Stephen's disability and his reluctance to accept a level of disability, and really his mindset once he was able to feel that he wasn't disabled, and use of crutches and things like that, which obviously are now newly relevant to me. So this is we talk about what's gone on in Parliament recently, and the politics of the SNP, and where the SNP now finds itself, and his performance as a Prime Minister's questions, but also just the things he's had to overcome from a young age and how he's dealt with them. So thank you for all your emails and tweets and messages and everything. I'm very grateful for the amount of people that have got in touch with me and wishing me well. And thank you for that. But without further ado, here we go. It's the leader of the SNP in Westminster, Stephen Flynn. Delighted to be joined by Stephen Flynn. Stephen, your career is already, you've achieved so much already and done so much, and you're not even 40 yet. I mean, how have you ended up doing so much so young?
I'm nowhere near 40. I'm only 35. Come on. it's been a wee bit of a roller coaster. You know, I guess, and I've been asked this question quite a lot by folk, is how have you found yourself in this position? And all of it's kind of been just based on grasping the opportunities that are in front of you. I have spoken quite at length about, you know, the challenges I faced being disabled when I was younger, and how that made me focus my mind and my life in a direction that it probably otherwise wouldn't have gone. And yeah, I ended up getting involved with politics and being a councillor and then standing for Westminster. And then obviously as the leader of the third party in Westminster, well, I would have been 34 at the time. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but I've loved every minute of it. And, you know, I've got an opportunity every week to quiz the Prime Minister, to outline how I think society could be changed for the better, to talk about the biggest issues impacting us in the UK, but right across the world. And, you know, you've got to grasp that opportunity as well as everything I've done in the past. And I like to think that I've been pretty good at taking those opportunities. And I would just, I'd encourage everyone to do likewise.
One thing you do really noticeable about you when you're on the floor of the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions is, you don't use notes. Is that something that you've trained yourself to do, or something that just came naturally anyway?
But it probably comes from the fact that you'll remember this, you know, when you're at school and you have to stand and give a speech in front of the class on a subject matter you knew nothing about, but you'd read a book about for 2 days and your hands would be shaking relentlessly. And then when I was a councillor in Aberdeen, I remember speaking with notes and my hands were shaking. And I couldn't stop it because I almost became fixated on my hands rather than the actual text. And I've just, from then on, I've always been of the view that if I'm speaking on something, I want it to be something that I care passionately about. And when you care passionately about something, I think you are able to talk about it in a style which is much more free and less rigid than the way a lot of people do. And that's not a criticism of folk, because people do things in different ways. And some of the best speeches I've I've ever heard have been from people reading off something that they've typed. But it's something that I'm really comfortable with. It suits me, and it allows me as well the opportunity to listen to what someone else is saying, because it's not just asking a question, it's responding to an answer. And it gives me the ability to be a bit more flexible, I suppose. And in some cases, like I do put a lot of pressure on myself. I mean, if you're given a fairly significant speech and you've got nothing in front of you, that can be quite challenging because you've got a message to deliver and you don't want to have any missteps. Or if you've got hundreds of folk heckling you, like in the House of Commons chamber, that can, you're probably setting yourself up for a fall at some point. Thankfully, I've not met that incident yet, but it's just something that I'm really comfortable with. And I think it comes across quite well, and hopefully folk find it engaging.
And obviously, in the Commons, it's that mixture of, you've got to command the floor of the house, get your point across, get your question in, without taking too long about it. So it's the economy of words as well, which is crucial.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's a especially when you're doing PMQs, so people can lose interest like really quickly in terms of what's happening. And after six back and forths with Rishi and Keir, you need to be in a position where you're able to capture people's imaginations, to try and create something which is newsworthy, to talk about something which is going to be relevant to my audience, which is primarily back in Scotland. So you have to be very careful about how you word things in what is effectively a 30 to 40 second window. And sometimes I like to go a little bit shorter than that, just to try and knock the Prime Minister out of his stride, because the longer you talk, the more time he has to think about what his answer is going to be. And there is a fun element to that. But then on other occasions, if you're trying to talk about something which is incredibly important, the detail matters. So what details you put in. But it's an important skill that I think MPs develop by necessity rather than anything else, just because of the nature of the House of Commons and the fact that it's so quick fire.
And how do you, because you've done it a few times, and obviously we'll come on to the parliamentary motion and all the fuss it caused. But at Prime Minister's questions, obviously you're using that as a way to hold the Prime Minister to account. You're dividing lines between the SNP and the Tories, but also you've got the Labour Party to your right, who are a bigger threat to you in Scotland. So you're trying to ask a question of the Prime Minister while laying a punch on Labour at the same time. You're trying to attack two people, but only one of them can respond. Like that must be a bit of a snooker move.
Yeah. There's sometimes a fair amount of thought that goes into to how you do that in a way which again is not clumsy, but it's quite effective. I've not been short ammunition on that, by the way, because sometimes I just listen to what Keir and Rachel say, and I'm like, that's magic. I can easily link the two parties together. But for me, I think it's important that, and in fairness, there's been a fair bit of bringing the Lib Dems into things as well, who obviously sit behind me, because it's not just about the SNP and the Tories, or the SNP and Labour, or indeed the SNP and the Lib Dems. It's about me being able to hold Westminster to account for the way that Westminster operates, and that transcends whether it's the Tories, Labour, or Lib Dems. It transcends them all and includes them all. And we need to, from my perspective, I need to be in a position where I can do that and try and do that as effectively as possible. And PMQs gives me that chance.
Do you enjoy it?
I enjoy the ability to embrace the platform that I'm given. And that's funny, I'm really self-critical, so if I get like a syllable out of line or I say the wrong word, there's a couple of folk in the team, and they know just not to speak to me for like an hour. So nobody even notices it's happened, by the way. But if I don't feel like I've landed a phrase in the right way, I'm so self-critical. Nobody else picks up on it at all. Just me. So I probably put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure that I get it right, because it's a big responsibility. And I mean, how many folk, you would love the opportunity to do it. Everyone would love the opportunity to stand up and quiz the Prime Minister on anything you want on a Wednesday. So yeah, you've got to enjoy that aspect of it. But there's got to be a means to the end, and there's a purpose for me, and that's to make sure that folk back home in Scotland know that we're standing up for them and we're talking about the biggest issues of the day.
And do you is the pressure that you put yourself on yourself, is that a pressure that you've always put on yourself, or is it a new pressure that comes with politics, and not just the element of public speaking, but because you're representing your party and you're trying to advance a particular political cause, that you feel like you're carrying that on your shoulders?
It's probably more just a personal pressure. If I'm honest, I try not to dwell too much upon the outside pressures and the level of expectation from all the party's members and supporters and the audience back home in Scotland. I think if I did that, I'd probably be stumbling my words out rather than being able to deliver some fluent sentences. But yeah, it's a personal pressure that I put on myself, and I think a lot of it goes back to just when I was younger, and that drive I had to always try and be the best at what it is I do, because of the circumstances that I faced in my own personal life. And yeah, I'm probably a far too much of a perfectionist in that regard.
And is it, do you think in a way you've come along at the right time? Because the SNP and what it's been through in the last few years, and the way that maybe politics has changed at a UK level, like Labour are more of a likely to form the next government than they were at the last, well, any election since 2010. You could even argue since 2005. That in a way, what has happened with the party basically, it isn't your doing, so it's not your fault. And then you've kind of got a bit of a free hit because the pressure's sort of off for a bit.
I don't know if the pressure's off in that context, because always pressure got us on general election this year, well, not likelihood this year. So there's always a huge amount of pressure. But look, all political parties go through change, and I guess it's how you manage that change and you adapt to that change, and the folk who, given the opportunity to take on roles, how they respond to that as well. And you've got to be comfortable with what it is you're saying. You've got to be confident in your ideals and your values, and remember why you're doing what you do, so that I can go back to my pals and my family back home, and they're like, yeah, like you're still the same person. You've not become a creature of Westminster, and to just get on with things. And the party's obviously had significant challenges over the course of what, the last 12 months or so. But you know, Matt, we are still comfortably, if the most recent polls are to be believed, so we're still comfortably ahead in Scotland. Around 50%, I think it's just above 50% of people in Scotland want Scotland to be an independent nation now. So there's a much bigger thing at play here. Yes, we need to get on, we need to win the general election, but we've also got a mission which is far beyond the scope of just Westminster, and that excites me and that intrigues me. And that change that the party has gone through, it's now up to us to deliver on that agenda that the party's had for such a long time.
Is there a sense, though, within the party? I mean, certainly after Brexit, it felt like if you'd have got a referendum, you could have won it. Now, just because of what's happened to Nicola Sturgeon and all the rest of it, and the way, Keir Starmer's a different opponent to Jeremy Corbyn and all those things that, and Boris has gone, is there a sense that actually that sort of magical moment where it was almost like a perfect storm for you? That the moment has kind of passed you by. Is there a sense, perhaps, among the party that, oh man, that was our chance, and we're going to have to work a way somehow to get those conditions back?
I've never thought of it in those terms specifically. I mean, politics is all about events, isn't it? And circumstances dictate how people respond to different scenarios and all the rest of it. But you know, despite the challenges that we've faced internally, and a lot of the narrative that's been out in the public domain around that, as I said to you, we're still ahead. But more importantly, that independence number, I think the last poll I seen was 53% in favour of independence. So those people haven't been dissuaded from what it is they want to see happen. And if you look at the younger age groups in particular in Scotland, the overwhelming majority of people, well, under the age of 30, under the age of 35, which I think classify myself sort of as,
just about to say, it's your age group.
Despite your attempts to add significant years onto me earlier, which I'll never forgive you for, if you look at those younger cohorts, the numbers in favour of independence are huge, and that's not changing. And, you know, it's not, we get really fixated on process and how do we get to a point where we have a referendum and what's the mechanism that facilitates that. And that's a pressure that the Labour Party are going to feel. That's a pressure that Keir Starmer is going to feel when he becomes Prime Minister in all likelihood later on in the year. How does he then ensure that the democratic will of the people of Scotland is adhered to? And it's a very different thing for a Labour Prime Minister to have to deal with that to a Conservative and Unionist Prime Minister to have to deal with that. And that's a challenge that Labour are going to have to rise to. All I can do and be confident in is the fact that I make the positive case for what I believe in, and, you know, hopefully folk continue to back us.
And would you rather Keir Starmer be Prime Minister of the UK than Rishi Sunak?
For a wee bit of context for you, Matt, I'm from a place in Dundee called Stobswell. And I also grew up in a place called Dundee called Whitfield, and lived in Brighton for a wee bit. And my folks live in Dundee at the moment. The Tories being in any way electorally successful is anathema to me. I don't want to see a single Tory MP after the general election. Their politics is not something which sits comfortably with me. And in fact, the fact that their politics is getting so much more extreme makes it worse than it ever was. I mean, if you go back to the generations of, like, my parents and the impact of the poll tax and all the rest of it on them, and you marry that legacy with where the Tories are at now, where they demonise migrants and they crash the economy and they do everything they possibly can to take Scotland, well, the UK, but Scotland by its very nature, away from its place within the European Union. All of these things are against what I believe and what I think the Scottish people, the people of Scotland, believe as well. So the Tories not being in power is a good thing for everyone. It's what Labour do with that power which is going to be the interesting thing. And that's the thing that concerns me the most, because if you listen to Rachel when she says we're going to stick with the spending plans that are put in place by the Conservatives, if you listen to Keir's lack of desire to do anything in relation to the energy transition and how you deliver green, sustainable growth in the UK. None of that's inspiring. None of that's the change that the challenge we face needs. And it goes against the grain that you see in Europe and what you see in the United States of America. So yeah, long story short, I don't want to see Rishi Sunak in power for a day longer than necessary. But what comes next needs to be something so much better. And obviously, I would say this, but I don't think the Labour's pitch is good enough yet. And it's going to be the job of people like me to try and drag them to a better place on their policies.
And how do you feel about the SNP's record in government then? Because it feels as if though even the party itself, now that Nicola Sturgeon's gone, thinks, really, what have we got to show for it?
Loads to show for it, Matt. And it's funny because I was speaking to someone just the other day about this, and if you're born in Scotland, you're into a baby box. If you are a young person, you get 1,140 hours of nursery care, which my kids benefit from. Well, one of my kids benefits from at the moment, and the other one will benefit from in due course. If you go into primary school, you get your free school meals. Then when they're going through their education, they can move on to get free university tuition. You get the free young person's bus pass in Scotland. If your eyesight's not great, you get your free eye tests and your free prescriptions if you're not well. If you go and take on ownership of a house, you'll pay less council tax in Scotland than you will anywhere else in the UK. The water that comes out your taps is from a nationalised company. If you want to jump on a train, it's a nationalised company. As you get older, you'll get free personal care and so on and so forth. The legacy of the SNP and being in government is extensive. I actually don't think we talk about it enough. I think because we've been in power for so long, it's almost the case that we've probably become used to all the good things that are there. Has there been challenges? Yeah, of course there has. Has some of those challenges been because of the financial situation that we face? Yeah. And, you know, there's this false equivalence that gets drawn between what Westminster does and what Holyrood does, because ultimately Holyrood's budget's set by Westminster. And if the Tories decide to cut Scotland's budget year on year, as they've done, there's a knock-on impact from that. But, you know, take the NHS as an example. Scotland's NHS, as Channel 4 outlined just the other day, has the best performing E&E in the entire UK. Is that of huge comfort to folk who are waiting a long time for to be seen? No, it's not. But ultimately, it is the best on these aisles. And it's the best on these aisles because of the decisions that we've taken. But beyond that, there's not been a single strike. There's not been a single strike in Scotland's NHS over the course of the entire cost of living crisis. That is in stark contrast to down here, where I was walking past St Thomas and there was picket lines pretty much every other week. And that comes from us being in power. And by the way, those nurses earn more in Scotland than they do elsewhere in the UK. So we can delve into things. And this is again something I'm really happy to do in relation to different policy areas, because we do have a good story to tell. But maybe the challenge for us is to be more assertive about that and remind people that this is what the SNP has managed to do with the limited powers we have. Imagine what we could do with all those powers, Matt. And that's the exciting thing.
Isn't the reality, some critics would say, that these successes in things like the NHS, Scotland gets more per head in funding than other parts of the UK, certainly more than England. All the SNP done have effectively passed the money on, and that's where you get the wage rises, that's where you get the capacity. And in education, which the SNP government had said would be its defining mission, actually the results are terrible. England outperforms Scotland in state education, and the SNP government removed Scotland from international comparison tables because the results were so embarrassing.
Well, I don't think that's why
So why did then? Why else? Why else? If you were top of the league,
they.
you wouldn't pull out, would you?
Well, the First Minister is obviously Hamza Yousaf put us back into those league tables. But when it comes to education, 95% of Scotland's young people go to positive destinations. So that means they go to university, they go to college, they go to work, or they go to an apprenticeship. 95% of our young people go on to do something which is productive and constructive to society as a whole. And that's again, that is a good thing, and we should be talking about that and celebrating that. And I don't want this to seem like I'm downplaying any of the challenges that there are within the education system, primarily because my wife is a teacher and would never forgive me for doing so. But it's for doing so. But it's there's big success stories in there as well, and we need to be proud of that. And yes, we need to get better in certain areas, but we've got a pretty good starting point to come from. And you know, how money is spent, that's all about political decisions. And it's for politicians to determine how they spend that money in order to make things better for people. So take, for instance, poverty in Scotland. The Scottish Child Payment, which doesn't exist anywhere else on these aisles, 25 quid a week right into the pocket of every single young person in Scotland who qualifies. And we know that that is going to lift tens of thousands of kids out of poverty. That's a political decision that the SNP took to take. If there'd been a Tory government, there's no chance that would have happened. Not a hope. So that's where we can talk about how we have delivered for the people of Scotland in government, and then obviously go on to that bigger picture about what comes next.
Obviously, fate takes people in different directions, but you know, the way you talk, does part of you wish you were in Holyrood and First Minister instead of being leader of the SNP Westminster Group?
It's I think for all nationalists, Holyrood is the place that you want to meet. It's Scotland's Parliament. But Westminster has a huge role to play in our lives. And I don't take for granted for any minute the responsibility that I have to make sure that our voice is heard down here. Now, I'm under no illusions. I'm not away to change Rishi Sunak's mind on what happens next. But we need to be here shouting for Scotland. And whilst we're part of the UK, whilst Westminster decides our foreign policy, our economic policy, our trade policy, our defence policy, and of course dictates much of Scotland's budget, I see it as my responsibility to be a pretty vocal advocate for Scotland's interests and to be that as big an advocate as I possibly can be. I mean, I get asked quite a lot, would you like to go to Holyrood and all the rest of it? And I guess most of us would, but we've got a job to do, a big job to do down here. And I also see a big part of our role is supporting Hamza, because I think Hamza's obviously backed Hamza to be the leader of the party, and the stuff he's had to deal with over the course of the last 12 months, he's fair risen to that challenge. And not just the challenge politically, not just the challenge internally within the party, but also the personal challenge as well that him and his family faced, particularly during obviously the situation with his wife's family being in Gaza, is it gave me a level of respect for Hamza, which I can barely describe, because to be able to continue to do your job when you have that personal challenge is quite a remarkable feat. And I've got real confidence that we're going to have a good general election, and that Hamza is going to take us into the Scottish Parliament election and win that for us as well.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You alluded earlier to the challenges you'd overcome, particularly with your health. Since your teens, you've suffered from a condition called avascular necrosis, which, how do you explain it? It's basically like your bones are dying without sounding too blunt about it.
Yeah, that's a nice way of wording it for your listeners. But yes, it's pretty true. Essentially, I was in school one day, from secondary school. I was like 13, 14. And I ran and hopped down a flight of stairs, which 6 stairs. And when I landed, I just couldn't get back up, and my whole body was I was dragging myself along the floor. I had to drag myself along the floor up a flight of stairs, and basically shout out for help. And nobody was there, which was a bit bizarre. But my dad, you'll remember this, mobile phones had just become a thing, and for some reason, I had this brick of a mobile phone. And I phoned up my dad, who was on his way to work, and he phoned the school. And I think it was a deputy head teacher came down. And yeah, that was the start of 18 years as a disabled lad, from the age of like 13, 14 up to 32, when I got my hip chopped out. Because essentially what was happening was, when I was walking, my bone was fragmenting off, because the blood supply to the top of my right hip had basically stopped, and the bone was just chipping off. It took them about a year or so to, well, maybe about 9 months to a year, to figure out exactly what the problem was, because all the pain was in my knee. But yeah, they eventually got to the bottom of it. I missed a lot of schooling. It was tough. It was really tough in my teenage years, because I enjoyed playing football. I enjoyed probably causing a wee bit of bother every now and then, and running about and doing all the things that teenage kids do. And it was all like in the flick of a switch, it was all taken away, and you're in a hospital bed, and all your mates are doing what they want to do, and you physically can't do it. So it was an experience which has certainly shaped my life. I actually never really spoke about myself being disabled until after I got my hip replaced. I think I'd sort of refused to want to talk about it or accept it on those terms, because I tried not to be. I ended up walking with one crutch for probably about 15 years or so. And when I actually came down to Westminster, I had the crutch. It was during COVID that I got chopped out. But it's been transformative for me to have a metal hip. I am the bane of Heathrow Airport's life with the scanners every week when I'm going back home to Aberdeen, and likewise when I'm coming down. But it's changed my life markedly, and a testament to the NHS. They looked after me really well for all those years, and I'm reaping the benefits of that now. But yeah, not a huge amount of folk realise that I do actually have a metal hip, or indeed that I spent pretty much my entire teenage years and my 20s, entirety of my 20s as a disabled man. Yeah.
So how much time were you in hospital then? Were you having to go back periodically, or are you there for like long periods of time?
Yeah, so to start with, I was in when I first fell at school, they took me to hospital, and I'll never forget that. There was no space in the kids' ward, so they put me in an adult amputee ward, and there was this guy who'd fallen off his motorbike, who was in the next bed, and had had his, I think it was just one, but it was maybe both of them. It's kind of hard to remember that exact detail, but he definitely had his legs amputated from the knee down. And I just remember having a chat with him. He was very philosophical about his life. He was a lovely guy. I was like 13, 14 in this ward. And I was just remember lying there thinking, geez, am I going to like come out here without one of my legs? I fell down a flight of stairs. I couldn't get back up, you know. But yeah, I was in and out of hospital for ages. They tried a whole manner of things. They had traction, which is when they pull your leg out the socket a wee bit to try and get the blood to flow. They did hyperbaric treatment. So there was a test tube in Ninewells Hospital in Dundee that they put me in and filled it full of oxygen. I went to a multiple sclerosis society place in Dundee, which had a pressurised hyperbaric chamber. So they would pressurise it and you'd sit with a mask on. They were wonderful people, because obviously that was all for those big squad of folk in there who were sort of suffering with MS, and there's me limping in on, I think it probably would have been double crutches at that point, to try and get some treatment. And I spent a lot of time with folk who were in much worse conditions than I was. Yeah, I had a physical ailment, but people had varying degrees of MS. And when I was in hospital, people had varying degrees of body parts missing and all the rest of it. And I guess that was quite formative for me. And it made me realise that that I needed to focus on what I wanted to do when I grew up, and it forced me to put a book into my hand to read, and I ended up becoming the first member of my family to graduate from university with a degree. So it's amazing how life works in that regard. And in fairness, I think a lot of the initial engagement, and I suppose success isn't the right word, maybe it is, with the party, the SNP, was, I would go out and deliver leaflets and chap on doors with a crutch, and it used to irritate me, like, that I would go and do this for hours, and I would climb up tenements with a crutch to campaign for something that I believed in, and I'd be like, where's everyone else? Where is everyone? Why are they not doing it? And I think for certainly some of the elected members up in Aberdeen, they respected that, and they were always, as a result, they were always very good at encouraging me to do other things and to get myself more involved, because if you're mad enough to do that when you're on crutches, the chances are you'll probably want to push yourself to do other things as well. So yeah, it was a really, really challenging set of circumstances that I had to face. I don't know if emotionally I've ever properly dealt with it. Like I said to you, I've never really classified myself as disabled until I was able to finally throw away the crutches. But it's something which was a huge part of my life. I was disabled for longer than I've not been disabled still, because I'm not 36 yet, Matt. but it's probably something which has shaped my life.
And like not having properly engaged with it, is that just because when you're going through it, you're like, right, at some point I'll be through this, however long it takes, and then I can deal with it then? Or do you not want to deal with it because actually you realise how much trauma you've been through and that actually might be quite upsetting?
Yeah, I think I was probably just afraid of being upset, if I'm honest. Because when you're, 14, 15, 16, 17, you want to be out exploring the world. And, you know, I was worried about going on the bus in case the bus stopped and I fell over or something, you know, because it's quite hard to walk on a bus with a crutch. Really difficult, actually. People don't understand the challenges that you face, or, like, you know, getting into a taxi or going for a longer walk or whatever. No, it was really difficult. There was one plus side, of course, is that, you know, as I eventually graduated going to pubs, it meant that I was the one person who never stumbled and fell because I always had the crutch to keep me upright. But, you know, joking aside, it was just something that I probably didn't dwell upon because I didn't want to be too upset about it. Because I remember feeling at the time that what I wanted to do, which was to be active and play football and all the rest of it, had been taken away from me. And I couldn't understand why that had happened because I was so young. But the bizarre thing is, you know, most of the people I know now, my mates, my wife, they've known me like that for so long, and a lot of them knew me. I've only knew me with a crutch. It was such a big deal for them to see me without one. That it was. I've always been really fortunate in the support I've had. And I guess when my kids came along, I wanted to be able to play with them at the park and run around and have my wee boy on my shoulders and all the rest of it. And now that I'm able to do that, that's probably allowed me to think more about what life was like before, because I've. In my mind, I've got it so good now, but literally I can go for a walk, man. That's it. I love just going for a walk.
That's a massive deal, because you're such a chirpy person. Were you like that the whole time? but you know, when you're going through all this difficult stuff, was that like a defence thing? Were you always like that? Or did you lose it for a bit?
I love the fact you've called me chirpy. There'll be a few folk listening to this. You'll be like, no, he's not. He's the least chirpy person I've ever met. I guess there is an element of a defence mechanism. Like I was always really conscious of the fact, and this is a strange thing, but it probably fits into the commons a wee bit. So everyone would look at you because you're 18 years old or you're 23. And you're walking down the street and you look physically healthy. I was always going swimming into the gym and stuff to look after myself. And I'd be walking with a crutch, and to a lot of folk, it would look like maybe he doesn't need it. And I was always just conscious of the fact that people looked at you and paused to look at you because you were different. And then occasionally you'd get people who would give you abuse, say your benefits cheat or all the rest of it. And occasionally you would respond to that. But there was always in that back of your mind, there was that judgment from people. They are deciding what is wrong with you. And you don't have a say in that. You're powerless. They're going to make their determination over whether you have a legitimate injury or not. And, you know, I guess an element of that, it probably goes into some of the stuff in the comments, because when you've got 400 folk bellowing at you, I'm like, guys, like, you're really not going to upset me here, because I spent years with people looking at me and judging me. So the fact that some posh guy from somewhere in England is like shouting in a language I can barely understand at me, isn't going to bother me. Like, calm down. And they've got to the point now, in fairness, where I tend not to get many heckles or shouted at very often, because I think people have realised that it's a water off a duck's
not
back.
Working.
But that's why it is. I think that's why it is, because I'm so relaxed in that environment because of the personal experience of what I felt. And this is the thing. I don't know if people were doing that, but I always felt like they were.
Yes.
And that's quite an onerous thing to take on, particularly as a teenager.
Obviously, this is something that I've got recent insight. So I'm still on crutches and spent a long time in hospital, where you worry that your optimism or spirit is somehow going to be broken. And then when you're out and about, one thing that I noticed on crutches is most people are very, very nice, but people are just so direct with you, and they'll say stuff like, "What's up with you then?" And I obviously can go, "It was cancer." They go, "Oh God, I'm so sorry." So one guy went, "Skiing accident, was it?" I said, "No, mate, no, it was cancer on the spine," and they sort of shit themselves and stuff. But it does all, the two things that you said that really resonate with me, it really opens your eyes as to how poor, and this is, you know, you're talking about when you were younger, which obviously wasn't that long ago, because you still are a very young man.
Thank you.
In 2024, some disabled toilets in places are terrible. And that there is no, there's still not good enough provision for people who are even on crutches, let alone wheelchairs. And it opens you up to how people react to you. On the whole, I would say overwhelmingly positive. But you realise, you can't believe that some of these problems haven't been solved already by politicians like you, Stephen Flynn.
Yeah, no, I know. It was, so what is it, like 1 in 5 people will be disabled at some point in their lives. And we probably, as a society, don't think about that enough and don't respond to it enough. And, you know, it's interesting because you look at Parliament and everyone's got their own personal challenges and their own health issues and their own private lives and all the rest of it. Is it as representative of the body public as it probably should be when it comes to things like disability? I'm not sure it is. So, you know, Matt, if there's a chance for me to use my experience to inform any sort of debate or whatever to make things better for people, then I'll definitely do that. God, I mind years ago there was a wee thing, they wanted to change all the taxis in Aberdeen to Hackney cabs, and I was like, nah, don't do it. I was like, please don't do it, because it's a total pain trying to get in one of them.
Step up into them.
Yeah, and then like, I'm quite tall, so you're trying to like lumber in. Yeah, it's really challenging. And we ended up, the council ended up not doing it, and because of voices like myself saying, this is like, it's easier to get into a saloon car. Now that's probably sound really boring to all your listeners, but for folk living it, it's real life to them, and it makes a big difference to their ability to go and enjoy things the way we do. So yeah, if there's a chance for me to use my voice to help others based upon the experience that I've had, then I'll try to do that. Now I suppose I'm a little bit more open and honest and reflective upon how difficult it probably was.
We couldn't talk without mentioning, not necessarily the vote on Guards and everything around that, but more about your relationship with Lindsay Hoyle. Obviously, he apologised in a way that I think few people have ever issued an apology, let alone any politicians. But obviously, you've still got an issue with him. I mean, have you met privately since everything happened?
So firstly, it's probably best that I start by saying that, you know, I've got a huge amount of respect for Lindsay. And me and him had actually a really good relationship. And I always felt from the conversations that we had that he was doing things in the best interests of Parliament itself. Yeah, after I made my intervention in the chamber, which wasn't planned, by the way. I mean, I was sitting up the back of the chamber. I was having a chat with Liz from Plaid, and then obviously events transpired, which turned the SNP's opposition day into a Labour opposition day. And yeah, I met with Lindsay the next morning, and you know, I'll not go into the details of the conversation, but I obviously told him that I'd be saying what I was going to say, and that I didn't have confidence in him, and I'm going forward. And you know, the reason for that, Matt's pretty simple. Is, you know, as a third party in Westminster, but not as one of the big two, we need to be in a position where our voice can be heard without any dubiety. And the only way that you can ensure that happens is that the rules of Parliament are stuck to. And the rules weren't stuck to, they were changed. And they were changed, in my view, because of a private conversation that Sir Keir Starmer had with Lindsay in a wee room called the Reasons Room, which sits behind the Speaker's chair. in Westminster. I'm told that the clerks were kicked out and it was just the two of them. And obviously, there was Labour MPs running around saying, here's a way to fix the speaker and all the rest of it. And, you know, that shouldn't be happening to start with, for obvious reasons. But he shouldn't be changing his mind based upon a conversation that he's had with Keir Starmer, irrespective of what he said to him. And ultimately, for us, if we've got to stand up for ourselves in the House of Commons, and that's what I sought to do during the course of events. And I think it would probably be in everyone's best interest that we had a new speaker in place who was able to play with an even hand, because I think Lindsay's shown his hand, and it was a Labour one, and that's not what his role was about. Because his role is actually really important for parliamentary democracy. I mean, I genuinely never thought I would be in the place as a Scottish nationalist where I'm saying the Speaker of the House of Commons is hugely important, but he is hugely important to how democracy works, and you kind of just change the rules on the whim of a political party. And, you know, like, there was a lot of discussion around, so it didn't end up being a vote at all. There was a lot of discussion around Labour's amendment. And, you know, the thing which I think was lost on loads of folk is I spent the entire afternoon going around to radio shows and elsewhere. I put it up on socials as well, saying we're gonna back it. Yeah, the rules have been changed, but we will back the Labour amendment. It's not exactly where we would want it to be. But it calls for an immediate ceasefire. They've finally been dragged by public opinion and parliamentary pressure from ourselves to a space where they'll back an immediate ceasefire. What I was saying was, I'll back them, and I hope that they'll back us as well, because our motion was slightly different. But because of what happened in Westminster, ours wasn't even going to get voted on at all. And, you know, that's not something that I can just sit back and allow to happen. Otherwise, what is the point of having days where we can set the agenda? And by the way, we only get three shots at setting the agenda every year. I think since November, the Labour Party have had eight goes at opposition day votes, and not once have they brought forward anything on a ceasefire. So, like, there was plenty of opportunities for that process to have been followed by them if they'd wanted it to be the case. But I've got no animosity towards Lindsay. I just don't think he can continue in that role if he's not got the trust of myself and others.
Some people thought that your wording was deliberately phrased to expose splits in the Labour Party, and that as much as people don't doubt your strongly held feelings about Gaza, that there was perhaps a political element to it. Now the rules of the House of Commons are one thing, but do you feel like perhaps to some people, in a way, the wording of your motion was slightly inappropriate, and that if you're seen to be political about these things, it can be counterproductive?
See, I've probably been the person who's spoken about, actually, I definitely have been the person who's spoken about the Prime Minister's questions, the situation in Gaza, the most since, obviously, since the reality of Israel's response became clear. You know, what happened on the 7th of October was abhorrent, and, you know, all of us have been unequivocal in our condemnation of that, and we need the hostages to be released. The response from Israel is and has been wrong for months. And I actually don't think it's contentious to say it's collective punishment. I mean, if you take away someone's food, their water, their electricity, their medicine, their ability to leave, and then you bombard them with some of the most advanced weaponry on the planet, that's collective punishment. I called it out as such months ago, and I think it would be remiss of me, and I think it would be foolish of me to then argue that it's not collective punishment, because I firmly believe it is. So all I was doing, Matt, and it's for others to decide what they want to decide over motivations or whatever, but I'm relaxed about it because I believe, I genuinely believe, it's collective punishment. So I'll call it collective punishment. If others don't want to call it that, then they need to explain what on earth all those things are to a civilian population if it's not collective punishment. So it's the only thing that did annoy me was that, you know, that procedural kickoff happened on something that was so important, because it was always about the issue, which is why we used our parliamentary time to bring that issue to the forefront of the agenda down here. And, you know, the PMQs that followed last week, obviously raised the situation in Gaza again to try and move Parliament on. So it was talking about how the UK votes at the UN, how it was talking about arms sales, how it's talking about whether we agree with the states that there should be an immediate ceasefire or not now. So this is an issue which is much bigger than all of us. It's much bigger than the party's policies on it. But I'm not going to shy away from using the platform I have, as I kind of outlined earlier, to stand up for the things that I believe in. I believe it's collective punishment. I believe there should be a ceasefire. I believe the hostages should be released. I believe there should be a two-state solution. I believe we shouldn't sell arms. I believe at the UN, we should be voting for a ceasefire. I believe we should be using our voice as a permanent member of the UN Security Council to argue for that immediate ceasefire. Some people now agree with me on that in Parliament. Not enough. We need to get more to agree to that view, and I'll keep at it until the UK Parliament changes its course.
And just before I let you go, you're a huge supporter of Dundee United.
I am.
And it's
Where's
only
this
fair
going?
that we mention at this point, you're top of the Scottish Championship, if only by a point, but nevertheless, on the brink of promotion as champions. Given how rare success can be for Dundee United fans, what would you genuinely rather see? What do you genuinely rather see? The SNP be the largest party in the next Westminster round of elections? Or I'll go even further. Dundee United not just promoted, but then following that up with being champions of Scotland.
Well, one of those things is definitely not going to happen. That's Dundee
And
United
the
being
other.
champions of Scotland. And the other, we will definitely win the election. But you know, it's pretty bold of a Nottingham Forest fan to try and poke fun at my football team, given the turmoil you guys have had over recent years. But you're
You're
doing
right.
well now. You're doing well, and all the better for
Oh, well,
it.
thank you. I know you've been to the City Ground, and I was back there at the weekend, and it's a special place. But I really hope Dundee United come back up, because ever since the days of Maurice Malpas, I've always had a soft spot.
Yeah, and was it Ray McKinnon who played for Nottingham
That's
Forest?
right. Oh my God, brilliant. I
Yeah,
loved Ray
played for United
McKinnon.
as well. Yeah, so did I. He's got a hat trick of free kicks. Now your listeners were really bored. He's got a hat trick of free kicks for Dundee United against Kilmarnock. That is the claim to fame of being a Dundee United fan right there.
If I can find that on YouTube, I'm going to include it on the link to the podcast. Stephen, this has been great. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Matt. Thank you.
Well, there you go, Stephen Flint. And he's absolutely right. Getting into the back of a black cab is a lot harder when you're on crutches. People sort of presume it'll be easier because there's more space, but actually lowering yourself down into a normal car and pushing yourself back up out of them is easier than having to step up into the back of a Hackney carriage and subsequently step down, particularly if you're on crutches. So it just goes to show these life experiences. You'd think being on crutches would be pretty straightforward, and on the whole, of course, it is. But my God, already in my brief time since I've been out of hospital, the last couple of months. And the limited things that I've actually been able to do in terms of going out and about. The provision of disabled toilets in this country varies wildly from place to place, even on the same street. So I am newly awakened to the issues facing people. And I'm very lucky that I'm on crutches and will be for a temporary amount of time, a temporary period. For people in a wheelchair, it's even harder. And I can't believe. Well, obviously, I'm not naive enough to think that we don't have any problems in this country and that services and access to services for disabled people still be below par. But still, there are certain basics that it drives you mad aren't provided. Anyway, enough of that. What a treat that was talking to Stephen Flynn and getting an insight on his life and his approach to Prime Minister's questions and to the Commons and to politics in general. I'll be back next week with another fresh episode. So you can please share this far and wide, leave a 5-star written review so that other people can find it, and I'll see you next time. Ta-ra!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.